Hey, Unwasted listener, Riley here. Just a friendly heads up that today's episode does contain some profanity. So if that's not your thing, or you're listening with young children, just wanted to give you a fair heads up ahead of time. Otherwise, I hope you love the episode.
How about we don't try and make food perfect, because it's not perfect, just like life's not perfect.
If you're recycling, that's awesome. But you also need to look at all these other pieces, and you don't have to be doing them perfectly.
The first step is reduce, then reuse, then recycle. They are in order.
Get inspired by people fighting to make this world better for everyone. This is Unwasted with Imperfect.
Hello, and welcome back to the Unwasted podcast. I'm your host, Riley Brock, and it's my honor every week to talk with experts in food, health, sustainability, and generally making the world a better, tastier place. Have you ever wondered why hunger in America is such a persistent problem, despite all of the volunteer hours, money, and yes, food that nonprofits throw at it every year? Today's guest is about to drop some much-needed knowledge on us all, so hold on. He's a nonprofit icon, speaker, and activist. He has won a humanitarian award from the James Beard Foundation, been named one of LA Weekly's People of the Year, as well as an Oprah Angel, and one of the 10 most caring people in America by the Caring Institute. I'm so stoked to have him with us today. Robert Egger, welcome to the podcast.
Right on, Riley. Glad to be with you, brother.
Really happy to have you here. Let's start roughly at the beginning. How did you first get involved in anti-hunger work?
Well, you know, it's funny, dude, since I was a young man, I've been involved in kind of changing the world work.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an older dude. I grew up in the, or I came of age in the 1960s. I'm watching, dude, with my own eyes, you know, whether it's Dr. King, Robert Kennedy, you know, Malcolm X. I mean, just, so I was a young, but open-eyed witness to some serious badasses, in American history. That really got me kind of in this kind of mood of which, you know, I'm going to dedicate this is the team I'm going to be part of.
Yeah.
Now, I ran nightclubs as a young man. That was my chosen profession. I was fascinated, and I still remain fascinated by how do you get people who are afraid of conversations to have the conversation? And oftentimes music, theater, art, dance, that's how you can get people to open up. So I really wanted to explore that. But I also, when I entered my 20s, is when homelessness really appeared. Now, again, dude, we all know there's always been people on the fringe.
Yeah.
But with laws that made it more difficult, rightly so, for police to roust people, what you started to see as a byproduct of these new kind of freedoms was, you know, people sleeping on the streets in front of the White House, behind the White House, in World Bank. And, you know, and again, you think about that. I mean, Washington, D.C., where I lived, I mean, that was a pretty powerful juxtaprism, you know, to see people sleeping out of the steam grates right behind the White House.
Yeah. So what?
Long story short, man, I went out one night and offered to help and encountered the charity model that you mentioned in your intro, you know, trucks going out every night to serve the poor night after night. And I just saw a little gap, not unlike, you know, the notorious Benz did with Imperfect, saying, hey, look, there's a ton of food being thrown away every night in restaurants, hotels, hospitals, caterers. If you can get that food, dude, you can feed more people better food for less money.
Yeah.
But my big jump was saying, you know, a lot of the men and women, you know, you're just going to serve people forever this way. It's going to be an expensive, endless loop. If you open up kind of a central kitchen, you could not only get all those efficiencies, but you could offer people a chance to be part of the solution, and they could come in and learn to cook.
Yeah.
And so in effect, you could create a nice little value exchange. Restaurants, hotels, or whatever would donate food. You would use that to not only feed people, but train people. You could shorten the line by the way you served it. And then the people who donated food would not only get a tax deduction and a decrease in their trash bill and a decrease in their pest control bill, and they'd get staff morale. They'd also get, on top of all that other good stuff, access to entry-level people who were certified food handlers. Everybody would win.
Yeah. You're solving one problem with, or we're really solving several problems with several solutions all in one model.
And that's always been my bag.
Yeah, you know, it seems
I'm in a maximum efficiency.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, you know, what's interesting, Riley, is, you know, sometimes simple things sell. You know, let's feed a child. Let's feed somebody. Let's rescue food. it sells. People are oftentimes happy with that little nuance. And I'm like saying, oh, dude, seriously? Come on, let's go so much further. And sometimes it can be confusing for people. And oftentimes, you know, again, people don't want to have the bigger conversation. So I think that's a little bit of my reasoning behind it. It's like I started developing this model that I built on the model of the Trojan horse.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, how can I get something that's so deceptively, joyfully simple that the average American, again, who doesn't want to have the conversation about who's hungry and why, how much food with the food system is broken and why, you know, they don't want to have that conversation. So again, part of the model has always been that nightclub world that I grew up in. How can I create enough flair and dynamism and excitement that people like, tell me more? And it's like, dude, okay, it's your idea. You know, if you want more, I'm happy to supply it.
Yeah. Was that hard in the beginning pitching this to people precisely because it was so new and so complicated compared to other anti-hunger models?
Well, you know, I always preface this response with, you know, I'm a white dude in America. What's hard? You know, I mean,
fair point.
And, you know, and this is what's really important, dude, because I had a young white man's confidence. So, for example, you know, when I opened or had this idea, I'm like, dude, I'm going to call up the Republican National Committee. George Bush Sr. is about to get inaugurated on January 20th. And this was like October, November. I'm like, I'm going to call him up.
Yeah.
You know, now that, A, white dude's confidence. Why not? You know, secondly, when they answer the phone, when they finally answer the phone and I realize, oh, dude, this is the decision maker right here. I said, hello, my name's Robert Egger. I'm a white dude name, you know, my voice. So again, think about how many doors open. Like if I had said, hello, my name is Jamal, would they have been as interested? You know, if I didn't, you know, speak in some kind of whitey McWhite way, would they have listened? Decent questions to ask.
Yeah.
But that, I always preface that idea of was it hard with those comments because I think it's important to acknowledge that. But, you know, I've always had a huckster's flair. You know, I'm good at selling. My pop, when I graduated high school, and I was his first son, and you know, he was a Marine Corps pilot. So, you know, he understandably had some kind of ambitions for me. But, you know, I saw the movie Casablanca when I was a kid, and that's what got me on this nightclub jag. And that's another story. But the point is, my pop pulled me aside on graduation day from high school because I had no interest in high school. And get this, dude, you'll appreciate it. Sidebar.
Yeah.
But I graduated in Springfield, Virginia in 1976 from Robert E. Lee High School, which just last night changed its name to John Lewis High School.
What?
I mean, actually, it's a fun combo to have today.
Yeah.
Because here I was at John Lewis High School, class of 76. And right after my graduation, my pop pulled me aside and he, you know, kind of bent over in my ear and said, son, you know, I'm really proud of you, you know. And, you know, he knew I didn't want to go to college. You know, I wanted to go work in a nightclub. And I made that very clear. And he said, you know, you ought to be a salesperson. And I remember kind of recoiling and being like, you know, dude, why would you say that? You know, but he's right. I mean, dude, I am a salesperson. I've always been a salesperson. I just chose to sell something that meant more to me versus made money for somebody else.
Yeah.
But no, dude, I got a huckster's flair that I love to apply to this issue because, you know, you mentioned it earlier, dude, and this is very important. You know, you mentioned that for decades we've been doing this.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many years I've been admonishing, begging, pleading, cajoling the larger nonprofit sector, but in particular the Anti-Hunger Network to, it's like, dudes, no one's buying your product. I mean, yes, there's pity out there for people who are poor. But most Americans don't want to really, until really, I think recently, quite honestly, with COVID, when it exposed so much. But historically, you know, the pitch of, you know, 1 in 5 children might go to bed hungry or food waste is wrong. You know, it's like those aren't erroneous statements. It's just they're not really moving the needle. And isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? So a lot of my bag has always been, you know, delivering high level impact, but always trying to find new ways to entice people further into the conversation so we get closer to the solution.
Yeah. And really embracing the nuance, it sounds like, and looking at root causes and not just what are kind of superficial band-aid things I can do.
Well, you know, dude, if you think about our anti-hunger world, it was primarily designed, I mean, dude, there's always been like the soup kitchen thing, and I despise that term. I've been around the world. I've never, ever been or seen a soup kitchen. It's a really archaic, knuckleheaded word, like homeless. Hmm. It kind of allows you to avoid deeper conversations, right? But anyway, I've seen so many things, like the idea of how many kids are hungry, how much food is wasted, all that stuff. But to your point, it's like, dude, that's fine, but why are people hungry? Like, you know, one of the wildest moments in my career was when probably about 3 years, 4 years into DC Kitchen, which opened in 1989 with George Bush Sr.'s inauguration. And we were kind of a metaphorical smash overnight. I mean, you know, I happened to surf right into the current that was cable television and the internet. Yeah. And with that, the food culture, the celebrity chef, the Food Channel, all that kind of came together right as I launched. And here I was, I mean, right below the capital of the United States. And I was really down to this idea of hyper-efficiency. I mean, Look at all the things we do before that meal goes out the door. Look at all the impact. But at one point, I remember I stopped and said, you know, wow, I've spent, you know, a couple of years now trying to develop one of the most undeniably efficient, effective organizations in America. I mean, everything I used was already there. I was really showing that what you could achieve with existing resources just used with some audacity. But I had to look in the mirror and say, yeah, dude, but you're still feeding working people primarily leftover food from a restaurant. No matter how good you dress that up, that's just not right. You know, so that's when I began kind of a parallel journey of realizing that I had inadvertently touched a fascinating nerve in America that still exists, which is our collective guilt about how much food is wasted. I tangentially knew it was there, but when DC Kitchen opened, I mean, it was like everybody from fucking presidents all the way down to kindergartners, there was this euphoria of our model, you know, or the idea that somebody was collecting food that would have been thrown away. So I decided to use that to see if I could, again, lure people into this bigger conversation about who's hungry and why. And also thinking, as I do constantly, about, well, okay, this might work right now, but what happens 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now? What does this look like? How can this be sustained? And if not, how do I, you know, run it into the ground with some style that, again, you know, doesn't just feed the poor, but challenges people to understand the role food can play in liberating people from being poor.
Hmm. That's interesting. That's the type of forward thinking you often hear associated with kind of startup founders, this idea of how does this scale? What does this look like 5-10 years from now? That's not always something I hear from folks in the nonprofit sector for some reason. I feel like the nonprofit sector is more, you tend to hear more about just maintenance. Like how do we get more funding? How do we keep feeding people? How do we, you know, do another pledge drive or funding drive? You know, what... In your early growth with DC Kitchen, how did you really try to build this model differently? Because it seems like from day one, you were determined to do things differently when it came to fighting hunger.
Well, you know, I've always been open source. And that's a huge point of this, because I've seen a lot of people try and monetize their knowledge. And it's like, you know, I'm not going to charge people or even remotely. I'm going to be completely 100% open, transparent, and share anything I have. Again, yeah. I was based in the nation's capital. I had the president of the United States donate food the first time. And again, those were advantages that other people weren't going to get. Yeah. And you have to make a decision. You know, are you going to absorb all light or reflect it back? And I became a reflector. There was an old, again, running nightclubs. There was a time I got to see James Brown a couple of times. And James Brown was one of the best performers, you know, really. I mean, you know, pre-Michael Jackson, Prince, you know, all this stuff. I mean, James Brown was, you know, Mr. Dynamite, you know.
Yeah.
But he had a song called "I Don't Want Nobody to Give Me Nothing. Just Open the Door, I'll Get It Myself." And that really struck a chord in me. Because to me, that's what I wanted to do. I've said many times my first experience with charity when I distributed food on the street was an example of the model that was based on the redemption of the giver versus the liberation of the receiver. Hmm. And my model was always going to be based on that. So again, there was a big part. Now, I also knew that homelessness was growing across America. Food waste was common in every city. So again, the model was saying, I'm going to take food that our society throws away, people our society undervalues, a kitchen that's wildly underutilized, volunteers that at this point was the beginning of the millennials coming in who were being mandated to do service, to graduate. Yeah. So the idea of an army of volunteers who want to make bold happen in their community, agencies that needed their budget stretched so free food that I could provide would help them do their job better, men and women, most importantly, who wanted off the street, chefs who had food that would donate but also teach and had jobs, all of that existed.
Yeah.
So part of my model was, dude, you've been told for decades you got to do this, 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 and this. And it's like, you know, look around your town. You're so much already there.
Yeah.
And if you really boil it down, you know, it became, there was all of the tools you needed to produce large amounts of healthier food that was currently available.
Yeah.
But more importantly, it was the idea of the hearts and minds, and in my mind, the votes of people who encountered us. You know, that if I could subtly not say vote for this person, but if I could open up their eyes to say, for example, man, I used to have, or DC Central Kitchen used to have all kinds of Republicans and Democrats come down because we were the closest and remain the closest functioning nonprofit to the capital of the United States.
Wild.
And each group saw something different. You know, to Democrats, it was social justice, social enterprise, fair wage. To Republicans, it was you're putting people to work. You know, now a big part of what I'd say is, you know, when a Republican would come up, for example, and say, I love this program, and you're getting people who might have been in prison back to work. And it's like, yeah, man, we do. But you know what? We partner with this insanely great drug treatment program down the street. And if we started to treat addiction more as a health issue and less as a criminal issue, I could get a lot more people working. Or if you funded those programs, programs like mine could then get 2, 3, 5 times as many people working again and paying taxes.
Yeah.
So I was always trying to find different ways to kind of put people in an intellectual corner where it's like, well, yeah, you got me. That's eminently practical.
Yeah.
And dude, at the end of the day, I'm an eminently practical American.
Yeah.
We want to see our country stronger, fairer, more just. And I'm just trying to be practical about the way I get to those goals or talk about them.
That's a great angle you take, this pragmatism as the bedrock of all that follows. I'm really curious to hear, what was the reaction when you would talk to these politicians and say, you know, I'm glad you like my model, but you could actually help this model by X, Y, or Z. You know, did you get pushback? Were they eager? Did things come of it? Like, what was the reaction like there?
Well, it depends on, you know, from a food waste perspective, we were wildly helpful. I mean, again, taking the model that we were lucky to be in our position and that we were obligated vis-a-vis that position to help others.
Yeah.
I worked with the Clinton administration very closely, and in particular, Secretary of Agriculture Dan Glickman, because, you know, if you can dig this, Riley, there was no data on food waste.
Yeah.
So the Department of Agriculture did the very first kind of study on this. And not only did they talk about the traditional food waste of farms and industry, but we really helped them open the door to the idea of kind of household food waste, but also restaurants and hotels and caterers.
Yeah.
So that was a big thing. And of course, I was very active in crafting some of the language around the Food Donor and Donee Act of 1996, which is kind of the bill that really opened the door to shielding all donors from liability. There was scattershot. Every state had food donor laws, Good Samaritan laws, whatever you want to call them, but there was no federal law.
Yeah.
Now, not only were we able to influence the Fed to look at this, but Marriott, for example, that family and that business is based in Maryland. And the Marriotts dug the DC kitchen and wanted all of their hotels to mirror they wanted to develop a food waste policy for their brand, their international brand.
Yeah.
So not only did we help them develop that language and that policy, but again, as I was helping other cities open kitchens, obviously the fact that a Marriott hotel or convention center in their town would be their number one donor was a great gateway. So yeah, I mean, again, the entire arc of the kitchen was designed to influence the way people think, be it, whether it was a volunteer coming in the door, a politico, a corporate person. And again, I could talk about a wide variety of issues to try and entice them into seeing this amazing opportunity. I mean, yeah. Dude, I never ask people for, say like, oh, please, please, please. My attitude has always been, this is great business for you, you know, and ultimately better business for us.
Yeah. That's like you said, that's the huckster or the capitalist attitude almost. You're inverting it in a very interesting way, I think.
Well, it's funny, man. Before the term social enterprise or social entrepreneur came up, I had a card that was, I was a righteous entrepreneur, I would call myself. but there was this idea of, yeah, man, I am an entrepreneur. I am a huckster, but I'm trying to sell something very, very different than my program. Now, again, I had to raise money. But, and again, I went through a phase, brother, of mocking a lot of nonprofit leaders and being frustrated by the sector at large.
Yeah.
Before I really dug deeper into the nonprofit sector itself. Like, why do we behave the way we do? And you really get down and you stop and you really look at, okay, I'm DC Kitchen and I'm part of this anti-hunger network, right? And again, I was very early involved with Feeding America and this kind of nascent movement of food recovery programs. Because here I was driving all over DC, picking up food, trying to build a training program. No one else had ever done it before. This was the very first job training program or community kitchen in America, to my knowledge.
Yeah.
And it's not like, you know, yay me. It just, it involved a lot of making it up as you went, you know? But at the very same time, I was trying to help other kitchens open and challenge the orthodoxy of food banking, which at the time, and sadly still, was fixated on the idea of pounds moved and agency served. And my thing is like, yeah, but pounds of what? I mean, you can't just poison the poor in the name of feeding the poor. You have to be focused on health, and you have to, you should be prioritizing food, because having come from the restaurant world, you know, I understood food business, and a lot of what I've been saying almost my entire career is, and it's very important for your listeners to dig this, food waste is lost profit.
Yeah.
Every morsel of food that Imperfect gets, DC Kitchen, every food bank, every pantry, every morsel represents lost profit. Ergo, the industry is going to get smarter and smarter about it's food waste.
Yeah.
And again, don't forget, and just so you know, man, a lot of what I've built my kind of thinking on is rudimentary probability. In other words, so for example, when I first started DC Kitchen, I didn't have a curriculum. We had volunteers from Cornell's hotel school come to volunteer. They volunteered to do a curriculum. I went to Cornell for the very first time and spoke at the hotel school. Then came cable television and the Food Channel, and suddenly everybody wanted to be a chef. So then suddenly you went from a time when there was only two great cooking schools in America, Johnson and Wales in Providence and the Culinary Institute in Hyde Park in New York. That was it. Everything else was just doodly squat. Suddenly they started to open up, Johnson and Wales opened up another one down in North Carolina. And suddenly there were cooking schools everywhere. That sets the stage for probability, because it's like, okay, if everyone now wants to be a chef and there's more culinary programs opening, each year a whole generation of chefs is going to graduate and come into the workforce with new quality control, new inventory control, new freezing techniques, whatever. But this army of chefs, as much as it represented a kind of a dynamic new part of American culinary cuisine, to me, it was like, these are the people that are going to decrease the food I'm getting.
Yeah.
So early on, I became kind of this dual thinker of saying to my colleagues, I'll spend 49% of my time hanging with you and talking about how to be more efficient, open a kitchen, whatever you want. But dudes, I got to spend 51% of my time trying to figure out what comes next, because there is no way we can sustain these models indefinitely because that food is going to eventually kind of disappear. It might take decades, but dude, we've been doing this for decades. So get hip. If you've been doing this for decades and nothing's changed, What makes you think suddenly doing the same thing for a couple more decades is going to change? The only thing that's going to change is the amount of food that's donated to you. And then, dude, this really was a big eye opener for me, is I started doing speeches about, you know, change and efficiency and, you know, all that stuff. And I got a gig down in Richmond to speak at the Meals on Wheels annual gathering. And this was probably 1999, 2000. And I was speaking with Enid Borden, who was a dynamic, delightful CEO of Feeding America USA. And she and I were talking pre me going on stage, and I was asking questions like, "So, man, what's the waiting list like? I mean, you know, I'm hip to Meals on Wheels, but I know there's a waiting list. What's it like?" And she looked at me and she's like, "In half of American cities is a waiting list." And I did one of those kind of like, you know, head turns. It's like, whoa. The baby boomers, the first baby boomer isn't going to turn 60 until 2006. And you're telling me there's already a waiting list for Meals on Wheels now. And there's 80 million baby boomers coming.
Wild.
And that's what really kind of metaphorically flipped my wig. Because I put those two things together, probability. The amount of food that will be donated will decrease because of better efficiencies, predictable efficiencies, at the very same arc in which the number of people who were hungry will start to increase. And that's what began a very, very more purposeful and at times a little bit more pointed conversation away from the idea that if we just recycle food, we can solve hunger.
Interesting. So that's really interesting. That basically you can't fully solve one problem with another. It sounds like you're saying on some level, you also have to evolve the conversation past just, well, we need to move the food around slightly differently.
And dude, you know, I was going up against at this time, even though I'm pitching kitchens hard, this is when a variety, I mean, by 2000, you know, six, five, six, seven, eight, nine, more and more people were becoming hip to food waste. Your generation was coming into its college years.
Yeah.
And that's when I got a call from Ben Simon saying, you know, "Hey dude, I'm starting the Food Recovery Network here at Maryland.
Yeah.
Would you be an advisor?" So I started doing that. You know, I started talking to all these young people who, again, were fixated on the idea of, if we can pick it up here and drop it off here, we fought hunger. And I would always be really polite and kind, but it's like, well, dude, anytime you feed somebody, that's cool. But that's not fighting hunger. That's feeding somebody for a day.
Yeah.
And that's when I tried to really talk to a younger generation about political action, social enterprise, creating jobs, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the root cause doctrine you're putting out there is really fascinating to me. And I think it's something actually I've heard from folks at food banks. You know, we had the CEO of Oregon Food Bank on the podcast, and she said quite candidly, look, like what we're doing is great, but if we're talking about solving hunger, not just treating it, we need to talk about poverty and we need to talk about healthcare. And I thought that was really revealing coming from her that, you know, even someone who runs one of these agencies doing amazing work to feed people in the Northwest is still aware of the fact that this goes deeper than just moving food around differently. We need to talk about, you know, income inequality and hunger and the fact that medical expenses are causing people to go bankrupt and go into debt, and that you can't, all of this stuff is interconnected ultimately.
Well, dude, you know what's hard? This is going to be bold, but that's like saying Black Lives Matter and not doing anything about it. And it sounds good to say it, but just saying it isn't enough. You know, you got to really take concrete, demonstrative steps forward to prove that you really believe it, or you're just, you know, trying to, you know, hey man, this will make me look good if I say this. And this is one of the things that for decades I've heard this conversation, yet it has been it's been pulling Hydra's teeth metaphorically to get the larger anti-hunger sector to move past pounds moved, agency served, and more importantly, draw a nutritional line in the sand about what they will or will not distribute.
Yeah,
this is a bold, hard statement, man. And I don't hold anybody, you know, guilty, but there is a culpability in the broader anti-hunger network for the health conditions that have made communities of color more vulnerable to COVID vis-a-vis the amount of food that for decades have been pushed into poor communities via pantries, via charity, that has created spikes in diabetes, hypertension, obesity. These are the three, I think one of the three main kind of illnesses that have made these communities much more vulnerable to COVID and other illnesses,
yeah,
or just a decreased lifespan. And yeah, I think we need to understand and frankly be quite honest about that past, but more importantly, not just acknowledge it, but change the behavior.
Yeah.
And that's what I long for right now, because pounds moved, I believe, has been one of the most disastrous flawed metrics in the history of the nonprofit sector, because there's no impact connected to that. All it just sounds good, looks good, and feels good, but actually it has been wildly detrimental.
Yeah. I spent some time volunteering at the Tucson Food Bank when I was in college. And I remember at that time, there was kind of a murmur amongst the staff that they really objected to the idea. This is in 2010, that Feeding America, who was one of their big partners, gave them tons of soda. Because to your point, it basically padded the stats. And Feeding America was basically getting, as I understand it, soda donations from, you know, PepsiCo, for example. And so in turn, they were then distributing of this soda in their boxes, despite the fact that it was totally empty calories, but it padded their stats. And to your point, made this donations total increase. So it's definitely it's a complicated road. As I understand it, they've since reversed that. I don't think they're distributing soda anymore, including it in their pounds donated. So I'd like to think we are making progress on this, but you bring up a great point that we can't just settle for feel good metrics. You have to ask, like, what is the actual impact of this? And are we distributing, even like to your point, the right type of food? You know, pounds don't matter if it's all empty calories. Like, we have to be asking, is this actually feeding people in a nourishing way?
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons that I've really become a convert to the role for advocacy, and in particular for SNAP benefits. That, and if SNAP really is the most affordable, effective, economically powerful way. I know many Americans struggle with the idea of like, oh, you're just giving poor people free food. But no, dude, it really bumps the local economy hard if yeah, people can buy food locally versus go to a charity
yeah,
and get odds and ends, you know. So there's that. But dude, you know, this is where it gets, my journey gets a little bit more complicated and a little bit more complex, is particularly in this era we're talking about, 2010, when Citizens United, which was a Supreme Court decision that gave First Amendment rights to corporations, but not to nonprofits, only to corporations. That is when, in particular, for this conversation, the food industry, ag, big ag, went to town.
Yeah.
And they literally set out. Now, they've always been wildly powerful lobbyists. And they have had in the Senate and in the Congress and in the USDA burrowed deep people who they had supported financially.
Yeah.
Now they were going to town.
Yeah.
Now they were going to town. So what you have now is a situation which the only way, and Riley, I don't like to use definitives like only, but in my opinion, the only way, and I'm going to step back for a second because I really want to make sure you get where I'm coming from. I've been to a million different gatherings of food groups,
yeah,
in which the crowd either chants or some speaker gets big applause for saying, we have got to take back the food system. And I'm like, okay, cool, great. How? Tell me how. And so what I started saying is, if you won't, I'll tell you how. There's only one way, and that's political. We have got to elect a generation of leaders who have a vastly different attitude about our food system. That's not going to fucking happen magically. And it isn't going to be a bunch of people pushing like on Facebook posts. It's going to have to be hardcore work. So one of the things that I've pushed for a couple of years now, and sadly with very little effect, is saying to a lot of groups that have convened people nationally that they had to be political, and that they had to recognize, in my opinion, that the only way to dislodge these well-funded elected leaders is to create an intergenerational political alliance between your generation
yeah,
and mine. Now, coincidentally, if you really tried to say, we got to get our generations together, most people would say, good luck on that. But there just happens to be, I think, a really powerful tool that we both have great common interest in. food.
Yeah.
You know, whether that's environmental work, whether that's worker rights, you know, whether that's fair wage, whether that's school food, senior meals. You got my point. That's a big umbrella. And to me, what Feeding America, what, you know, all the groups that convene around food, there should have been, in my opinion, in the past, but there must be in the future, efforts to create a political movement around two generations of people. Again, man, don't forget, your generation was raised doing service. So for you, for many of you, well, I think this is why you've seen so many young people coalesce around Black Lives Matter, because they, you were raised to be activists, you were raised to be bold. Now, my generation similarly was raised to be bold. Mm-hmm. We just got middle, you know, kind of middle-aged, middle class, and fat, and got lazy. But that doesn't mean that we can't be redeemed and called back to the front line.
Yeah.
So that idea of finding what's the closest common denominator to get young people and old people active, engaged, side by side, working together, it's food.
Yeah.
So to me, man, if I could do anything right now, I'd love to explore the idea of helping to create an intergenerational political alliance, because that's how you're going to take back the food system.
What a powerful idea. That really sticks with me.
I only trade powerful, dude.
Amazing. Speaking of powerful alliances, I want to talk about your friendship with Jose Andres. How did you two first meet?
Oh, dude. You know, it's so funny. I was talking to Jose earlier this week. We had a board meeting for World Central Kitchen, and I'm happy to be a founding board member. And but anyway, Jose was just new to D.C. He had been hired by another friend who happened to be on the board of the DC Kitchen, Rob Wilder, and they wanted to open a tapas restaurant. It was the first one in DC for sure, and probably one of the very first in the United States. And they hired this young dude to come from New York, this young chef. And the DC Kitchen had always brought in guest chefs. And sure, it was to help teach, but it was also, I wanted to help teach chefs about the power of hiring some of our graduates who were, again, able to demonstrate when they did their cooking classes, their commitment, right? So that relationship between students and chefs was a big part of our successes. So Jose, Rob said, hey man, we got this new young chef coming in. I wanted to get him down there to the kitchen. I'm like, sure, dude, anytime. I'm gonna bring him on. So they walk in one day and there's Jose, 23, 24 years old, I think. And, man, we just hit it off like peas and carrots. Huh. But more importantly, what Jose really dug was, you know, one of the big leaps for the kitchen. We've talked about a lot of the efficiencies and everything's already there. But you know what I did was remove something that was always there, which was the metaphorical distance between volunteer and recipient or, you know, whatever. It was like when I first served food out of a truck, I was up in a warm truck serving out a window down to someone. Most of the time when you volunteer, there's a table between you in which I am now serving you. There's that split. I have power. You don't.
Yeah.
And I'm like, let's take the table away and put everybody around the same side.
Yeah.
So the idea of every volunteer from Presidents Obama and Clinton to a wide variety of people, they work side by side with students in the program. Hmm. So again, imagine the President of the United States or a young chef new to town standing next to someone who's been homeless their entire life or an addict for 20 years or in prison for 20 years.
Yeah.
That was what we really, that was kind of the secret sauce of the DC Kitchen. But that really impressed Jose because he said, again, he said this week at a board meeting, for some reason, he got on an origin story jag. But he's like, you know, I've never worked next to someone. I mean, side by side, and he talked a lot about, he's from Spain. He's like, you know, I didn't really interact with people who were black or brown, you know? So that, and then more importantly, I think that motto we have of, it shouldn't be about the redemption of the giver. It should be about the liberation of the receiver. Not mutually exclusive. Because I need redemption, dude. I'm a grade A sinner. I'm just a sinner who's trying. But I'm not going to get my redemption at the expense of another human. If I can set a stage in which we're both mutually engaged in creating a more just world side by side, hey, that's the way we roll.
Yeah.
So he dug that too. And that that began what has been now almost a 25, 28 year journey of partnership that went from DC Kitchen. And he showed up one day in my office, which was a little mop closet. And he sat down and he's like, you know, I have a new idea. It's like, what, dude? And he's like, World Central Kitchen. And I had to laugh because I'm like, okay, dude, I have DC Kitchen. You have the rest of the world. That's that's so Jose. But you know what's so funny about this, Riley, is his almost superhuman abilities has slowly been revealed to his friends. I mean, you know, he would always come in with these wackadoodle ideas. And I'd be like, Jose, that's fucking nuts. And then he'd do it. And it's mind-boggling. Now he, to his amazing credit and to his deep humanity, and to my embarrassment at times, he never hesitates to say at a speech or a question is kind of metaphorical debt to DC Kitchen and to me for our meeting and for opening his eyes, blah, 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 blah. He could have quit doing that decades ago. You know, he doesn't have to mention me. He's long surpassed me, but it's funny, man, because we've been on this journey together for such a long time. And while he has the ability and the capacity to take this message to tens of millions of people and to feed tens of millions of people, there's still this very joyful relationship in what comes next. Where do we go next?
Yeah.
And what's the opportunity? So it's kind of a journey we've been on.
Yeah. He's such an inspiring figure. I mean, I've heard him speak on podcasts. I've heard him mention your name on podcasts, which I thought was really awesome. To your point, he seems like a very humble man, despite being at this point a celebrity chef with dozens of restaurants in multiple states and countries. And you know, he's just got such a halo of respect around him, but it doesn't seem like he's let that go to his head. You know, what have you learned from him?
Well, you know, dude, just to speak to that for just a second, because I've seen a lot of chefs who do this kind of work for their own self-aggrandizement or whatnot.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be, believe me, he's as much a huckster, if not more. I mean, you know, we're both hucksters.
Yeah.
But I'll give you an example of something that yesterday, just when I think I've seen it all when it comes to Jose's humanity. Yesterday, he won like the International Basque Chef of the Year or some award to that extent, you know, with that kind of name. And it came with €100 prize, which is probably about 110 grand, 120 grand. And he just last night said, I'm going to divide it between the 10 other finalists and myself. So he's just going to divide it by 10 and give all the other 10 finalists, you know, a cut. And I looked at my wife, Claudia, it's like, damn, you know, now that's how it's done.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and get this, Riley, you know, you mentioned he's got all these restaurants. They're all closed. You know, they're all closed. And Jose doesn't get a salary from World Central Kitchen. He's not on the payroll.
Yeah.
You know, so here's a guy who's got no money coming in. And, you know, dude, 100, you know, isn't bad money. He gives it away to other people. So anyway, but, you know, what have I learned from Jose? Well, the power of maps. Dude loves maps. Anytime you do an event, like we're doing an event, like I did a thing here in Santa Fe with the community college here. You know, I called him up and said, hey, man, COVID's hit northern New Mexico. And plus I got an itch for a new model. You know, we haven't done anything in a community college. And they got a culinary school that's closed. I've talked with them, and they can reopen their culinary school, and students can actually get credit hours for working with World Central Kitchen to produce meals. There's a greenhouse, and the students there can get credit hours for providing fresh fruit and produce or produce. There's a nursing department. They can get credit hours. So the idea of connecting education with disaster work. And we did about 50,000 meals over the past few weeks. But it's funny because I called them up and it's like, hey, dude, I'm thinking about this. Do you, you know, would World Central Kitchen be interested in partnering? He's like, what are you calling me for? You should be cooking. Go right now. What? Go. But, you know, again, man, I think he has been really good at hiring really smart people and giving them control. And I think too many founders wrestle with that idea of, I'm only as good as the people around me. And the oldest line in the book, a true leader does not create followers. A true leader creates other leaders. And he's been really good. Nate Mook, the CEO Dude, that guy's the bomb. I mean, the dude is just, he's a machine of love and butter and impact. I mean, the guy makes it happen every day. You know, that program, and there's a guy, Sam Block, who's the director of operations. Man, the dude is, he parachutes into volcanoes or into earthquakes or fires or COVID. And boom, immediately, kitchen. I mean, within 2 days, thousands of meals are going out the door. So I've been wildly impressed. But Jose recognizes that, you know, his real power is in policy. And I think that's where you're going to see his next big influence is going to be in the idea of a Department of Nutrition, a Department of Food at the federal government level, because it would be really great to see the USDA kind of taken apart a little bit. It's a Gordian knot, and the opportunity to really look hard at our food system and frankly, big ag. The time is now.
You know, one thing I think is really admirable about you is that you have such a directness and honesty and candor with all of your work and all of your communications. And something, you know, I encountered this personally when, you know, Imperfect had been working with you closely when you were working at LA Kitchen, and you sent out a really kind of heart-wrenching, honest email explaining why LA Kitchen had to shut down. Can you walk us through kind of like what happened there and you know, what did you learn from that experience?
Well, you know, you can be too far ahead of the curve. And I always like being ahead of the curve because I feel like I'm a little bit of a of an explorer. You know, I'm trying to see what's next. You know, what is the source of food? Who's poor? What are we going to do? What are the political stuff? But dude, as I mentioned earlier, I became fixated on how do we reconstruct a senior meal so that we can feed the millions of older people in America who will be, who are going to live 10 or 15 or even 20 years longer than they have money in the bank. And the only way to do that is plant forward, period. No discussion. And this isn't healthy. It's not about the environment. It cannot afford meat every day, period. Yeah. Of course, again, we can talk about health and all that. So I went to LA, a community where I grew up, saying, here's a place where I can get an almost an unfathomable supply, even though donated fruits and vegetables, as much as there's an ocean of it now, this is the last big source of free or reduced food in America. So let's really look at the way you stretch it as far as possible, not just mirror the historic model of redistribution. So I opened up a very elaborate kitchen so that I could, in effect, chop, dice, puree, juice, zest, cryovac, which is shrink wrap, freeze. I wanted to really play with a healthier food, a different structure of a meal to move away from the four compartment tray where meat's in the big part. I also wanted to look at how to extend the shelf life of food as long as possible. But the model was based on a two income stream. It, one was philanthropic that would take donated money and donated fruits and vegetables, which were Imperfect was so generous. They were our anchor donor partner. Insane food came in through you all. But we would use that to train young men and women aging out of foster care, older men and women coming off from incarceration, one of the very first purposeful intergenerational job training programs. While they were learning, they would in turn teach other volunteers, and we would produce thousands of plant-forward, again, that's meat as part of the meal, not center of the plate, but plant-forward meals for seniors and others, but an emphasis on seniors. And then we would have a for-profit side that would purchase reduced price, but fair market value, fruits and vegetables. We would hire graduates and we would compete and win contracts to do the senior meals for LA and LA County. Now this was, there was an advantage because LA had passed, and your listeners might be interested in what's been known as the Good Food Purchasing Act. And that was a, you're starting to see these around America. But what it does is it either suggests, as it did in LA, or mandates, as it does in other cities, that any city agency that spends over a certain amount of money every year on food needs to make an effort to check a variety of boxes, of which buy local, pay a good wage is part of it.
Yeah.
That's what I did. So part of me is like, not only will I give you 2-for-1 meals, not only will I train and engage older men and women in the training program and in the ball of tennis thing, not only will LA now be at the very forefront of senior nutrition of the future, I won't, money will never leave town. If you get a higher LA Kitchen, you can check all your boxes for the Good Food Purchasing Act, but hey, I'll just put all the money back over into the charitable side. You'll get thousands of meals every day for seniors. I just ran into there, and I think for any of your audience who's interested, the desperate need for procurement reform in America, because what I ran into was a system in which big catering companies or big food companies like Aramark, Sodexo, Compass Group, they're not evil people. They just have very bad baked in advantages over social enterprises like LA Kitchen.
Yeah.
By the time I realized that no matter how much I spent, and I went into a hole trying to kind of prove that I was the best thing that ever happened to the Department of Aging in LA. And before I realized, they're not interested in any of this. They're deeply wed to this kind of corrupted system in which low bid, and just for your audience, many contracts, school food, prison food, it's all based on who's the cheapest.
Yeah.
And so what I had to close LA Kitchen, because at the end of the day, that model, it was too big to run exclusively on donated philanthropic donations. And I hadn't pivoted fast enough to develop a new income stream because, dude, all I wanted to do was feed old people. That's the future, whether I like it or not.
Yeah.
So it was a real, it was a hard thing.
Yeah.
But again, Riley, you know, it's funny, man, because for the first time in my career, 30-year career, I had made payroll without fail for 30 years, never missed a payroll. I had opened kitchens all around America. I had helped other people. I was purposeful, but it didn't work. And I just had to acknowledge it. Now, but I also had to stop and think, okay, you're 60 years old. What are you going to do now? And I had to stop and realize that the world doesn't need another 60-year-old white dude trying to stay relevant. That there is a different opportunity for me. That my impact and the ripples of my thinking still go out through Jose and dozens of kitchens around America. The best thing I can do now is be available for younger entrepreneurs and help them strategize, help them build their model, help them think about opportunities of the future. And so that's why I moved here to rural New Mexico, and I live very, very modestly. My wife and sister-in-law are here in a nice little family unit. And I'm running my hand at growing food and eating the food we grow here at our little house. But anyway, I live a very simple life, but work very hard to be available for free to anybody who wants to, an open ear, an affirming opinion. You know, I'm just here.
Yeah. That's super powerful. I appreciate you sharing that. It strikes me one of the takeaways is that in a race to the bottom with prices, only the big fish can win. Like when it's this scrappy battle to just underbid everybody else, it's only the huge consolidated, vertically integrated players that are going to emerge. Like it's really hard, to your point, for a nonprofit or something with a higher purpose to emerge victorious when it's just like all about the lowest price.
Well, that's why the two things I push hard whenever I talk to anybody. I'm like, you need a political ally. Hmm. And particularly, you know, there shouldn't be an election anywhere in America at any level in which candidates don't have a food policy. And you need to elect people with a solid food policy. And part of that means you need to actually have allies to go in and move from low bid to best value. In other words, if you're going to spend city money, state money, what's going to get the best long-term value? Going back to the original idea behind the DC Kitchen, how can I use all these existing ingredients to get the best impact? Similar.
Yeah.
And then more importantly, there's another rather, because you hit a nail on the head, Riley, which is most of these big companies, they'll lose money on an individual contract because they're interested in the aggregate purchasing power of all the contracts. And this is why 99% of the time you'll lose.
Yeah.
But more importantly, there's an even more insidious factor, which is a thing called rebates, which is with that aggregated purchasing power, they get great prices from big companies like Kellogg or General Mills or Kraft. And oftentimes there's an under the table, basically a bribe that goes to school systems or whatnot to keep with these companies. So we need to not only go from low bid to best value, but do away with rebates.
Yeah.
And that that, in my opinion, will open the door so wide for a new generation of food entrepreneurs to come in. But until that happens, this is why, dude, I've said it isn't the most popular opinion, but all roads lead to politics and policy. Ultimately, you have to elect allies who you don't have to. Historically, the nonprofit sector thinks, oh, a new mayor's in. Let's go in and educate them on our issue. And I'm like, let's elect people who are already educated and talk on day one.
Yeah, well said. Very, very blunt and to the point. I want, you know, the last major question I have is just, you know, you spoke to this with LA Kitchen and you've written about it in your book, Begging for Change. You know, what do you see as some of the commonalities of successful nonprofit work? And then on the flip side, what are some pitfalls you've seen?
Well, again, I think there's a lot of individual nonprofits might be able to escape the orbit temporarily of the funding thing, but we're all trapped, I believe, in a system, the nonprofit thing, in which most people, and particularly people of power, have a bifurcated lens in which they see .com and .org, charity and business, as separate. And they, more importantly, see .com business as the drivers of the economy. My thing is what's going to separate us and take the nonprofit into a new era is when we as a sector embrace the mantra of no profits without nonprofits. And that's an economic principle that says, no town functions or can thrive without arts and culture, communities of faith, healthcare, education, clean air, clean water, all the things nonprofits do. We are and have always been equal to business in the vitality of a town. Yeah. And until you elect a generation of people who say, I get it, I don't need, you know, that I want to support both. I can't run my town without each. Until the nonprofit sector owns its collective economic and political power, we will remain servants in the fields of America.
Wow. Really, really well said. Powerful words there, Robert. I want to get on to the speed round here. Some fun closer questions here to wrap us up and help folks get to know you a little bit better. You ready to go?
Rock on.
Amazing. All right. First one, is there anything you'd encourage folks listening to follow up with or explore more in their own time?
Yeah, man, procurement reform. It's the number one thing. That's what will make the food system rock.
Is there a place folks can go to learn more about that, an organization or something? Or
yeah, actually, right in San Francisco. I can't remember the name of it. Paula Daniels, my old friend from the LA Food Policy Council, runs it. But it's based in San Francisco. But if you look at the Good Food Purchasing Act, it will take you there, and they can give you all the information you need to make one happen in your own town.
So cool. If you're cooking for somebody and you want to make them feel loved, what are you going to make for them?
I'm a big salad man. And you can put lots of things on or in a salad. Anybody can be welcome. It can be simple and humbling. It can be really ornate, but I love salads.
Awesome. And what's a positive change you've made in your life in the past year that you think more people should try?
Well, at my age, I have two choices. I can cut back on meat or tequila, and it isn't going to be tequila. So I've really done a lot less meat in my life than I have in the past.
Wow. We always try to pick a pull quote for each episode, and I'm really tempted to just pick that one. I could either cut back on meat or tequila, and it's not going to be tequila. Delightful. What ingredient could you not live without, and why? And why is it tequila?
Well, ingredient, I think the two greatest flavors of all time are lemon and bacon. Lemon and bacon, to me, have packed the most flavor. But lemon, I don't know what it is. I rejoice in lemons.
Awesome. What is your least favorite thing to waste?
Life.
Well said. What is your go-to karaoke song?
I don't have one, but it would be Wild Thing, probably.
Awesome. Never too late to start karaoke, Robert.
No, dude, you know, it's funny because I have a lot of friends who can sing, and I can, you know, everyone says, oh yes, everybody can sing. And dude, if I could sing, I would love. I mean, nothing, the idea of making a joyful noise is, it, to me, it's the one thing I lament. I wish I could carry a tune.
Yeah. Oh. Well, everyone has their lane, I suppose. Who's somebody you admire tremendously, and what do you admire about them?
Well, you know, again, I have to admit, I admire Jose. I really must admit. I mean, you know, I know that's kind of a go-to, but we have just been friends, but I'm fascinated by his humanity and how he is. At 2 o'clock in the morning, you'll get a text. But he's always thinking about how can I serve?
Yeah, that's awesome. And finally, what are you grateful for this week?
The patience and love of my wife. I've been married we've been married 36 years, and I'm always amazed by the redemptive power of my wife. I'm so lucky to be married to her.
What a touching note to end on. Robert Egger, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a real pleasure. Where can folks learn more about you and the work that you do?
Well, I painted myself in a corner, but my website is fuckingshitup. If you just look up fucking shit up, that's me. And I'm r.egger@fuckingshitup.net. I mean, I have other emails, but that's me. And again, dude, it's important to know that when I say fucking shit up, I don't mean with a brick.
Yeah.
It's with your brain, you know, with your heart, with your spirit, with your work. You know, Dr. King wanted to fuck shit up, you know, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, they all wanted to fuck shit up. I do too.
Excellent. We'll have links to your website as well as everything else we've talked about today in our show notes and on our website, thewholecarrot.com. That's where this podcast and all of our podcasts will live. So definitely check that out. Robert Egger, thank you so much.
And Riley, dude, thank you, man. And again, props to Imperfect. You all have been a great ally to not just LA Kitchen, but programs like LA Kitchen all over America, man. Mad props.